This episode of Bend the Knee is brought to you by Lord Jason of House Ross, Sir Jared of House Blackfire, Lady Amanda of House Richardson, Lord Adam the Young Bull of House Parker, Sir Peter of House Whittingham, the Ghost of Harrenhal, Lord Nelson of the Long Isle, the Mother of Cats, Sir Joshua of House Ross, Lady Kendall of House Taylor, Lady Liz of House Hendricks, Hand to the Hand, Sid Say, Asback of Day 11 in the Light of the 11, Lord Hunter the Foulmouth, Captain of the Guard, Sir Dustin the Rooster Knight, Captain of the Guard, Sir Ron of House Golson, Captain of the Guard, Lady Amanda, Captain of the Guard, and Lord Robert the Unfrozen of House Butler, Lord Paramount of Skagos Island, Captain of the Guard.
Hello and welcome to Bend the Knee, a Song of Ice and Fire podcast. I am Sir Matt, the Bud Knight.
And I am Sir Ezra the Watchful. Welcome to our Song of Ice and Fire book club. Today we are into Brand 7 of A Game of Thrones, and in the Maester study we will be discussing the Kings of Winter. But before we get to all of that, let's meet some of our bannermen, our patrons. We think it's kind of time to start featuring more of those, and so Sir Matt has a quick little shout-out to one of our members.
Yeah, hey, you know, one of our longtime listeners, Lady Jade, she's like, sorry, I haven't been active in the group lately. Well, it's because she had a baby, so I want to give her a shout out to Sir Zachary. I think said he's about 9 pounds. So I just want to wish him a happy name day.
Yeah. That's awesome. That's so cool. Yeah, Sir Zachary, welcome. You know, your mother's going to be, hopefully, when he's ready, you know, the Dunkin' Egg series is there for him, right? So
yeah.
Start reading that right away if you can, but because we're going to need your participation here in the years to come, in the wars to come.
Yeah, I mean, here's the real question. When he comes of age, so let's, I think that the Hedge Knight series, the Dunkin' Egg series. I feel like you're probably about ready to read that when you're about like 14. I feel like that's kind of an appropriate age for it. Like,
yeah,
it's still not like a kid's book, but it's like a teenage book. So let's say 14 years from now, do you think girl have the books done by then? Or
wow, I don't know. I really don't know. This is the prediction of all predictions. By year 14 for Sir Zachary, will the whole series be done? I don't think so. And unfortunately, I don't think George will still be alive. I don't
know. Wow.
I'm just kidding. I'm kidding. He's probably going to outlive me. You know, I got to start.
Well, yeah, how old is he? He's in his 70s, right?
Yeah, I hope he lives till he's well into his hundreds, quite frankly. Hope we all do.
Well, you know, modern medicine.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, he's 70 years old. I mean, so 16 years, so 14 years from now, yeah, he'd be 84. I mean, that's getting, you know.
He'll be fine. We'll take care of him.
There, yeah.
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 He knows people like Melisandre and, you know, the guys from the Citadel.
He said in a recent interview that the end of the TV show was a liberation because now he feels like he can do what he wants.
Yeah. Good. Good.
That's what I'm saying.
That's awesome. Get after it. That's cool. Well, I mean, there is another TV show starting up, so.
Yeah, well, we'll see what happens then.
Yeah, I wonder what's going on there. But, okay, cool. So, we also kind of thought we would start something, you know, just sort of like a featured patron. Every once in a while, we're not going to do this maybe every week, but from time to time, a couple times a month maybe, we will go over and feature one of our patrons. And so Lady Liz of House Hendricks has been with us for quite some time. One of our bannermen, often on Raven's Nest. And, you know, just I just felt like we wanted to kind of shout some of you guys out here quickly and things, and read over some of their most recent Facebook post in the group or what have you. Even if you're not in the group, we've got Ravens. We've had Ravens from her before. So she has a sick, by the way, tattoo. This like that she posted the other day, like a video of this tattoo that is like quite awesome. It's Game of Thrones inspired, and so she's working on, let's see, House Martell, right, is the next little thing to be added there. So that's pretty cool. She has her own personal direwolf, 120 pounds, 3/4 German Shepherd, 1/4 Husky. pretty sick. I would not cross him. So, but yeah, she's keeping us up to date on this tattoo, which is absolutely sick. And she's often in the Discord server. Whether if she's not been on the episode, then she's been in the Discord server, kind of giving us comments and giving us some theories and stuff there. So, shout out to her. Just a huge, you know, member and I mean, really important member, vital to the group. And just I don't know. I just felt like wanted to give her a shout out. And you know, next week we'll feature somebody else. But because you guys deserve it, man. I mean, it's like this podcast would not run without you guys. It's like Raven's Nest is so cool, and it's so much better to hear from you guys. We have a raven at the end of the show, by the way, that's going to blow your guys' minds. So, you know, we'll save that. But, I mean, like, some of the stuff that we get, Sir Matt, is just unreal. Unreal.
Yeah. Yeah, and the raven we have at the end of the show, it's an amazing creation that the amount of time that it would have taken to put together is crazy because it requires reading the entire series,
right,
and paying attention. So it's going to be cool.
Right. Yep. Pretty awesome. So, all right. And then also with that, as I said before, every once in a while, we're going to give a shout out to our Sworn Swords. Here we go. To our Sworn Swords, we thank you. Sir Anonymous of House Anonymous, Sir Austin of House Jeffords, Lady Cloy of House Swain, Lady Denisha of House O'Brien, Lady Dawn of House Watson, Lady Hannah of House Farmer, Sir Jake of House Jacobson, Sir James of House Nutter, Sir Jeffrey of House Wilson, Lady Jessica, Sir John, Sir Matt of House Zink, Sir Ralph the Dornish Wolf, Sir Samuel of House Wakefield, Sir Sarah of House Thompson, Sir Sean of House Brunos, Sir Joe the Graco Knight, Sir Stephen of House Vilken, Sir William of House Lombard. All right, my friend, On to the small council. How you doing?
Hey, man, I'm good. You know, I'm I feel like I'm just running 1,000, you know, 1,000 miles an hour.
Yeah.
Just gearing up, as we get closer to a Clash of Kings, there's just a lot of things that Sir Ezra and I keep teasing it, stuff we're talking about. There's a lot of stuff going on behind the scenes, and just getting it all ready.
Yeah, it's a task and a half. I mean, we keep kind of perfecting the show, trying to take your guys' feedback and make it better. So, yeah, a lot of work to be done. Also, it's a crazy time for Clash of Kings to be starting because, you know, you had a couple transitions in your job earlier in the summer, you know, just some things you were working on. And then now I'm about to start. I just started actually last week back up to teaching. So Lord, I have a lot of things to get done. Seven hells, my friends. It's just a little bit crazy around here. So if we don't get back to you right away, that's probably what's going on is I'm starting into the school year and we're trying to do some things behind the scenes to make the podcast better. So, but yeah, I don't know. I mean, busy.
Yeah, the kind of for those of you guys who are in the Night's Watch tier and above, that reward is coming. We just recently decided to kind of add one more thing to it, so we're just kind of getting that piece together. It's going to take a couple days, and then those are going to be sent out here shortly. So,
yep,
you know, just trying to take care of you guys.
Yeah, for sure. And another thing we kind of thought we would do is, you know, adding in the featured shout out. I mean, just because it's something simple we can do, get to know you guys. A lot of times organically, I was telling Sir Matt, it just happens throughout the show. We'll get something from, you know, our captain of the guards. We have a segment now dedicated to the captain's report because those guys are in the Facebook group and I can just search them and I can pull up a survey or a poll that they did. And it's kind of a neat, it's the evolution of the show, if you will. So, trying to find ways just to give it back to you guys, and we've said since the beginning we want you to be able to influence the show, influence us, and help make it better. So it is what we all make it, if you will. So
yeah,
all right, awesome. So any other? Well, this is important. Okay, the most important part of the show is that you guys go follow us on social media. Okay, because
it affects
my self concept and my self esteem. Okay, if I don't, I'm just kidding. But seriously, you should go follow us over there on the Twitterverse. You can follow Sir Matt there at Super Gains Bros. And you can follow myself at WompRat_2M.
Mm-hmm. That works for Instagram as well.
Sweet. So yeah, cool. All right. Any other channel updates? Anything else going on, Sir Matt?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. All right, then, moving on to the captain's report. So Lord Robert the Unfrozen of House Butler is at it again. Actually, there's a really cool poll that we're working on right now. But last week's poll was, who is Varys truly? And the top results for that were a Blackfyre, a common Lysene thief, Brightflame, or a faceless man. So kind of interesting just to get a pulse on the group as to what everyone is thinking or who they think Varys truly is. He's a bit of a mystery man, right? He's kind of a man of many disguises. Maybe
I think he's I think he is just a commoner.
Yeah. I think he's just really good with his network. He's just really well informed.
I think he's just like the opposite of Littlefinger. Like they're both like the same type of a thing.
Yeah. It's cool to think that there is more to it, and that is what George does in his writing, is make us think like, well, we were just talking last night, we had done our musing for this month in regards to Rhaegar and the Blue Roses and stuff, and whether was it prophecy, was it love, was it a political maneuver, why did he crown Lyanna Stark the Queen of Love and Beauty? And it's like, I want to think there's more to it. I want to think it's something epic, but sometimes it's just really normal and mundane, and there's really not a whole lot to it. So I don't know. That's how he writes. That's what he makes us think. And that's why we have these polls. So anyways, cool beans there. Coming up this week, I think this poll is about to end. So we'll get to it maybe next week. Where is it? Oh, okay. So Quaithe warns Dany about the perfumed Seneschal. Right, so the question is, who is that? And we got a couple options there, so we'll go over that next week. But that's a great one, Quaithe, bringing Quaithe back into the equation. So, all right, that's it for the captain's report. The Maester study is cool. I mean, Sir Matt's got something for us today in the Maester study.
Yeah, it's a little piece from the chapter here. When I was taking notes, just caught my eye, and it's not something I really thought. I mean, it does allude to something we do see in the books much later, but it's really something where it's like, wow, after watching season 8, this makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
And, this week we're talking about Bran. And so this is the chapter where Bran finds out that Ned Stark dies. But at the beginning of the chapter, he is sitting and he's watching these knights. Well, then he's watching people in the yard fight with Sir Roderick.
Yeah.
And so he's talking to Maester Luwin.
Yeah.
And he says, you know, there was a knight once who couldn't see, Bran said stubbornly, as Sir Roderick went on below. Old Nan told me about him. He had a long staff with blades at both ends, and he could spin it in his hands and chop two men at once. Simeon Star Eyes, Luwin said as he marked numbers in a book. When he lost his eyes, he put star sapphires in the empty sockets, or so the singers claim. But that is only a story, like the tales of Florian the Fool, a fable from the Age of Heroes, the Maester tisked. You must put these dreams aside. They will only break your heart. Mm. Well, I don't know, because right. You know, a somebody who was blind,
come on,
you know, and then somebody who uses a staff with blades at the end.
Uh-huh.
I don't know, I'm just saying, sounds an awful lot like somebody we see in season 8.
Yep.
I mean, now Arya isn't blind when she has the staff with blades at the end, but obviously she is blind and she fights, you know, the waif with the staff.
That's right.
There, and that's how she learns how to do it. So it's just cool.
Yeah.
It's Simeon Star Eyes is mentioned in all of the books. That includes the United of the Seven Kingdoms, World of Ice and Fire. I don't know if he is mentioned in Fire and Blood. I don't think that the A Song of Ice and Fire wiki has really been updated fully yet with all of the stuff that's in Fire and Blood. But sure. So it's probably possible.
Yeah.
But so regardless, he's mentioned in everything. Maybe somebody we see in the prequels.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. I was thinking that too. So they actually said Age of Heroes. So, I mean, that would be kind of cool to meet this character. So, yeah. And it's neat, you know, once was blind, right? Arya was blind and now, and you know, using the staff, and then it has Gendry build that for her. It's just, it's cool. I did not put that two and two together there. I just like, oh, it's a cool weapon. She learned how to use it or whatever. But then there's a connection to this legendary character. You had said it's kind of like she gets to live out, you know, this I don't know, this dream of, because
right, I mean, her ending is almost like Nymeria, right?
Yeah.
With her sailing off, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, all the heroes that they loved and kind of revered or whatever, she kind of embodies that for us. So pretty cool stuff. Now, also in the Maester study, just because we don't spend a lot of time on this in the chapter, I thought I would pull out some of these Kings of Winter. It happens, a whole paragraph is dedicated to just listing these kings. And so I'm going to pull these up in order and just kind of read from the wiki real quickly about these characters. So at some point in the chapter, Bran and Maester Luwin, Asha, and Summer go down into the crypts. And as they're down in there, Maester Luwin asks Bran to kind of recite the histories and to identify each of these old Kings of Winter. And he does. And the first one he mentions is Jon Stark, who was a king in the north. Now remember, that it starts off as he goes down through the crypts. We'll get to the description of it, but these were kings in the north, and then later on you'll see that they start to turn to lords. Some of the older kings and ancient kings are in the levels below, I would say. But Jon Stark was a king in the north, head of House Stark before the War of Conquest. All right, there's a statue of him down in the crypts. The history on him is that when Sea Raiders landed in the east, John drove them out and built a castle, the Wolf's Den, which we've talked a little bit about, right? And what it is now. Now it's kind of it's a prison, I believe, right? It's a place where Davos ends up later. And there's like hidden little passages connecting it to House Manderly. But yeah, it's down there. It's at the mouth of the White Knife, and that's where we'll see House Manderly later on. But yeah, it's just a little neat connection there that he built that. He was able to defend the mouth of the river. And then the next king we see, his son, Rickard, followed him on the throne and actually is able to kind of win, gain the neck and add it to the north, if you will. So he took the neck away from the Marsh King and took his daughter as wife. So that's what we get from him. He is also known as the Laughing Wolf for his good nature. So that's pretty cool. Next up is Theon Stark, who is known as the Hungry Wolf. He's described as like very thin, kind of wiry, right? And he's constantly in a state of war. So it's kind of why he was known as the Hungry Wolf. He's there during the Andor invasion, which is pretty cool about. I was just reading up on when the Andor influence. We get it at the end of this chapter that the North was the only kingdom to not basically be defeated by the Andals and convert over to the Seven. And so I'm guessing during that time is Theon Stark. He's there defeating the Andals and the various warlords that had showed up. He later on conquers the Three Sisters in the Bight, landed an army on the Fingers. So he's just constantly at war. Pretty cool character. We can go into more on him later. He's mentioned also again later on in the Dance of Dragons. So that's pretty cool. Brandon Stark, the shipwright. So Brandon the shipwright is the next king that we see there. And he basically, is he the one where his grave is empty? Yeah. Yeah, he was known as Brandon the shipwright due to his love of the sea. Thousands of years before Aegon's conquest, King Brandon attempted to sail across the Sunset Sea, but was never seen again. So Arya, we know at the end of Season 8, we'll kind of do the same thing. What's west of Westeros?
Nobody knows.
No one really knows. We've never had anybody come back and tell us, like, oh, it's actually just the Far East. It's just the other side of Essos. You know, it's the Shadowlands or whatever. So, yeah. Let's see. It is known that he never visited Dashai. His tomb is in the crypts of Winterfell. But it is empty. His son burned the remaining ships in his grief and thus is known as King Brandon the Burner. So that's who's up next. And that is really what he is known for. He's referenced later on just in reference to Lord Wyman Manderly, rebuilding this war fleet. So it's, the Starks aren't known for having a bunch of ships and things and having a shipyard and stuff. And Wyman Manderly decides that's something he's going to offer to Robb, the new king in the north. So pretty cool there. Now moving on, Roderick Stark was a king in the north, head of House Stark, and he is, I believe he's right before Torrhen Stark, who we know is like the last king in the north. Not much is said about him other than that he basically won Bear Isle, and he takes it from the Ironborn, and he won it supposedly in a wrestling match. So, you know, there's some maesters questioning the authenticity of that, but Roderick Stark is just known for taking Bear Isle. Cool. Torrhen Stark, we get a lot about him as the king who knelt, right? He was the head of House Stark who reigned as the king in the north until Aegon Targaryen invaded Westeros with his dragon. So during Aegon's conquest, when the Targaryen reign starts, he is the king in the north. And basically he witnesses, Sir Matt and I covered this quite a bit in the early days of the podcast, he sees everyone else is just getting wasted, right? Just getting wasted. He did mm-hmm. have a plan, though. He had sort of an air quote contingency plan. I believe it was was it Brandon who was carving those
the weirwood arrows,
to possibly kill one of the dragons. So that's kind of cool. Little reference to maybe there's something in those that those arrows could be special if they're carved from the wood of a weirwood. You know, maybe. But he is known as the king who knelt, and saves. He's restored then as lord of Winterfell, which is cool. And there's a lot more to him, but that'd be a lot to cover. So essentially, he's the last king. After him, we have mentioned Craegan Stark was the lord of Winterfell, head of House Stark during the reign of Viserys I, Aegon II, Aegon III, and Daeron I. He briefly served as Hand of the King for Aegon the Third after the Dance of Dragons. So we've talked about that a little bit. Just after the Dance of Dragons, he kind of comes down. Isn't he the one who, isn't that the Hour of the Wolf or something,
mm-hmm.
Sir Matt?
Yep.
Yeah, when he comes down and sort of sits in judgment for a short time and then returns back north. Later in his life,
which is really cool, and that is one area that Fire and Blood gives us like a little more detail as to what actually happens, because World of Ice and Fire is pretty short. It just says it kind of happened, but Fire and Blood gives us a bigger in depth about that.
Yeah. Something neat about him as well. It says that he fought Prince Aemon the Dragon Knight, who we know is, I mean, often sung about and is super famous. And Aemon claimed that he had never faced a finer swordsman. So one of the best swordsmen in the Seven Kingdoms would be Craegan Stark. So, and that's pretty much it. So we then get into sort of like Brandon Stark, and we get into Lyanna Stark and their father, Rickard Stark, right? But that's, we kind of know those characters a little bit, and we'll continue to discuss them throughout the series. But I thought it was kind of cool. They went back in time and just pulled out some of these major characters. And then George later on, I mean, this book is written first, right? We're in a Game of Thrones. Later on, we'll go on and he expands on all these characters. So all the stuff that I kind of listed off and that we read about, the extra little tidbits, were given to us later in A World of Ice and Fire, or in Fire and Blood, or later on in the series. So just some cool little connections there. But all right, I think that's it. Okay. I think we are ready for the reread.
All right. Last week, we were taking a look at Arya 5, where Arya is surviving on the streets of King's Landing by hunting pigeons. When she hears the summoning bell, she joins the crowd to watch her father confess his treason. Once the confession was done, King Joffrey demanded his head. Arya attempts to get to him, but Yoren of the Night's Watch stops her. Afterwards, he declares that she is coming with him. It's been a while since we've been in a Bran chapter. The last time, Bran 6, Bran was watching the Karstarks arrive. Then he went to the Godswood to pray. He is interrupted by Osha, who tells him about the old gods and the others. She insists that Robb should march north, not south. Bran passes her advice to Maester Luwin. Then Robb marches his army south. So it's been a while since we've been with Bran. So Bran 7. Bran and Rickon are having the same dream about seeing their father in the crypts of Winterfell. Maester Luwin takes Bran down to the crypts to show him his father is not there. They find Rickon already there. They go back to the Maester's turret, where Luwin tells them about the coming of the First Men, the treaty of the Children of the Forest, and the coming of the Andals. The Raven arrives with the news of Lord Eddard's death.
Mm. Yeah. it's a good chapter, but it's tragic.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah. So, as always, I like to read just the first little bit here. The oldest were men grown, 17 and 18 years from the day of their naming. One was past 20. Most were younger, 16 or less. Bran watched them from the balcony of Maester Luwin's turret, listening to them grunt and strain and curse as they swing their staves and wooden swords. The yard was alive to the clad of wood, punctured all too often by thwacks and yowls of pain when a blow of struck leather, or flesh. So, you know, and then I talked a little bit about him watching, and that's when we bring up Simeon Star Eyes. So, yeah. The chapter kind of starts off, and it seems actually pretty relaxed for Bran. Although, you know, as readers, we know what just happened in the last chapter.
Mm-hmm.
And so for Bran, it's kind of a normal day. They're training more men to help, send south probably to help garrison Robb. But it doesn't really seem like anything would be terribly, terribly wrong.
Yeah, I mean, Yeah, sort of a normal day, as you say, and we know that tragic news should be arriving. We're kind of surprised, maybe at the start of this chapter, that they don't have the news yet. And there's a good reason why George does that, because they had news last night, but not in the form, that Maester Luwin would accept.
Or be able to see.
Yeah, yeah. And so what's also neat about this is they do explain that, Robb has taken all the men south with him, and before that his father took some of their best, so they need men to kind of walk the walls and to shore up Winterfell's defenses, essentially. Like, what if those other men die or they come back wounded? I mean, you have to find the next best and start training some of these young boys to be guardsmen or captain of the guard or man right. the wall,
and
whatever.
And kudos to Maester Luwin, because he's a character who I think in the show he seems really, really cool, and even in the books, he doesn't stick around all that long. But I mean, he's really quite literally holding the fort down.
Yeah, yes, he is.
I mean, Catelyn's gone south, so it's him with Bran and Rickon,
right?
And he's really helping Bran make all these decisions. You know, a young boy who's now crippled, and he's things aren't really great for him. And then Rickon is really young, and so Maester Luwin's there just running the show.
Yeah. It's his duty, his responsibility. I mean, he could, if he were a lesser man, like take advantage of it or maybe get caught up in this power that he has or whatever, but
mm-hmm.
he just does what's right, leads by example, and tries to do his duty. And it's just to help run Winterfell, which is a big, big deal.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, you're right. I mean, it's...
Yeah, I mean, like, here's a line here from, Bran looking at these. Bran stared resentful at all the sweating boys below. If I still had my legs, I could beat them all. That's Bran's side of it. That's what Maester Luwin's dealing with. He's in a really tough position here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it's not just like he's dealing with a boy lord. He's also dealing with one who has a lot of baggage and issues right now,
mm-hmm.
and is trying to help him focus on his studies, his knowledge of history, which is kind of ironic, and just with what Bran's training wound up being, and get him to see that he can use his mind. His mind is a tool, and it can be a weapon as well that he can use when as he gets older. So. Bran keeps trying to figure out ways to make himself still become a knight. He says, I can ride Hodor, right? He could be my legs, and I could cut these guys down. But, Luwin says that, the mind and the has to kind of connect to all the body parts, really, and that it's has to become one, if you will, and he has to really have complete control over Hodor's body to be able to do something like that. And there's a bit of foreshadowing in that, because we know Bran will later take control of Hodor and does use him to fight. So that's interesting.
Yeah, yeah. And then Bran tells him here right after the Simeon Star Eyes, a fable from the Age of Heroes. The Maester just, you must put all these dreams aside. They will only break your heart. The mention of dreams reminded him. I dreamed about the crow last night, the one with three eyes. He flew into my bedchamber and told me to come with him. So I did. We went down to the crypts. Father was there and we talked. And he said, and why was that? Or he was sad. And why was that? Lewin peered through his tube. It was something to do about John, I think. The dream had been deeply disturbing, more than any of the other crow dreams. Hodor won't go down into the crypts. The maester had only been half listening. Bran could tell. He lifted his eyes from the tubes, blinking. Hodor won't go down into the crypts. When I woke, I told him to take me down there to see if Father was truly there. At first, he didn't know what I was saying, but I got him to the steps by telling him to go here and to go there. Only then he wouldn't go down.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, there's something. When a dream like that, I mean, he literally believed he could walk back down there in the daylight and see, during the day, to see his father. So he wants Hodor to take him down there. Hodor won't go. Later on, we'll see that Summer is not willing to go down there either at first. He stays on the top step for a while until they push on in. But, yeah, this is another dream that he has. He goes on to say, too, that in the dream, it seemed that his father, as you said, was sad, but he's also talking about John. When it's like, what was he discussing? It was John. So that was kind of interesting. Then the first king we see down there is John Stark. That's referenced. Now, we normally get a lot more details about the dreams that he has with the Three-Eyed Crow. And in this one, we really don't. We don't really get like a conversation or a dialogue, or we just get that he was there and he was sad. And he was mentioning John. So I kind of wonder, it was that vivid. I'm sure that maybe it's a dream we could refer back to. Maybe some of the last words that Eddard Stark said to his son that may come back into play. But we normally just get more. And I'm unsure as to why we didn't. If it just he wasn't remembering it. And also Bran as a young boy, this was about his father and he just wanted to see him. So the details weren't really that important. Maybe, you know, the conversation wasn't that something about John. He doesn't really know, but his dad was there. He wanted to go see him. And you know, so he's crushed, to wake up and realize it's just a dream, but it's such it's a Three-Eyed Crow dream. So there must be something to it. And he tries to go down into the crypt.
Yeah. You know, I like this line here, just cause it is a little bit of foreshadowing. You know, the maester tugged at the chain around his neck, as he often did when he was uncomfortable. Bran, sweet child, one day Lord Eddard will sit below in the stone, beside his father and his father's father, and all the Starks back to the old kings of the north. But that would not be for many years. Gods be good. Your father is a prisoner in the Queen in King's Landing. You will not find him in the crypts. Which is actually true. You know, I don't even think his bones have made it all the way to the north by at the end of A Dance of Dragons, have they? I'm pretty sure they haven't. They're still with like the Silent Sisters or something.
There's a bunch of speculation, right, as to where they were. Catelyn kind of comes across them, thought they were, remember, quite small. I mean, just right. And looking at them and was sort of like, what? This doesn't feel right.
Yeah, so even though he's dead at this point, he still isn't sitting down in Winterfell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. What's her name? Goes down there. Barbary Dustin goes down with Theon Greyjoy to see Eddard's statue, and is trying to, you know, pay some respects. There's also that great conspiracy that's going on during that time as well. But she tells Theon that if she ever discovers the location of Eddard's bones, she will never allow them to be buried in the crypts along with his ancestors in revenge for Eddard's failure to return her husband's bones to her. So there's just a quick there's speculation as to where are his bones, where are they at, and what's going on.
So there is a statue down there, but his bones just aren't down there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, but yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. As you say, you know, he's not truly there. And this is part of what causes people to go wild about, like, the idea is that he's still alive or somehow the death was faked or what have you. It's just crazy because we don't see him. We know what happened last chapter, and it's all from Arya's point of view. We don't really know from his point of view what him being taken in chains up there, what he was forced to say, all that kind of stuff. That's just not known to us, really. It's just we see him there on the stage making his atonement or whatever, making his confession, and then Joffrey, you know, does him in. So
yeah. You know, back to the chapter here. Bran and the Maester are still just kind of arguing Bran saying, "I seen him in here. I want you to go look for him." I believe I can solve that. And so essentially they're, you know, getting ready to go down.
Mm-hmm.
Even Osha, you know, she says, "I live my life beyond the wall. A hole in the ground won't fret me none, my lord." So she's the one who ends up taking him down there. "Summer come," Bran called as she lifted him in her wiry strong arms. The direwolf left his bone and followed as Osha carried Bran across the yard and down the spiral steps to the cold vault under the earth. Maester Luwin went ahead with the torch. Bran did not even mind too badly that she carried him in her arms and not on her back. Sir Roderick had ordered Osha's chain struck off since she had served faithfully as well since she's been at Winterfell. She still wore the heavy iron shackles around her ankles, a sign that she was not yet wholly trusted, but they did not hinder her for her, her strides down the steps. So Bran says he couldn't recall the last time he was down there. It had been before, for certain. Certainly before, when he could at least still walk down there.
Yeah. And you know, two things about that. Something that's interesting is as they start to walk down, there's a great fear in going down here. I mean, Osha's not, you know, afraid to go down in here, as she said, because she's been up north. But once upon a time, these children would play down there, and it wasn't a place of great fear. So I think that's interesting because now it is. Something's changed. And another thing about Osha is that I read this somewhere. People were speculating on how she got south of the wall. I think we've talked about this before. We talked about how Mance Rayder was there at he was there when King Robert came to see Eddard. And he came with some other, possibly, maybe he came by himself or he came with other people. Some people speculate that her desertion from him happened to be when she was south of the wall with Mance, perhaps.
Yeah.
So she may be closer.
I would say so, because that would put her roughly around the same point in time.
Mm-hmm. In the same area. Maybe she went into the Wolf's Wood and was doing her thing, scavenging, hunting, whatever, and then comes across Rob and Bran. And so anyways, I
wonder,
cool.
do you think they climbed it, the wall? Do you think Mance Rayder climbed it and Osha climbed it? Or do you think that they know of a gateway or something?
I don't know. I actually think if it's Mance, he may know of a secret way or be able to get through the wall. Kind of similar to how Sam does.
Right, because that could also explain the dire wolves being down there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, beyond the whole, you know, like Blood Raven theory and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know if it says, I can't remember off the top of my head if it says that he sailed around, if it gives us more details on how he got there. People have looked at the timeline and tried to figure out how quickly, it seems like he got there rather quick, and then is back beyond the wall quickly too. So I don't know. There's a lot of different thoughts on that, but I just thought for Asha, you know, and her folks.
Well, is it 100% confirmed that he was there?
That's the thing.
Or is that I thought that was part of a theory.
Yeah, that's the thing, is that people believe, right? He says that he saw John, right? And that he had been there. As a bard or something, right?
Yeah, I think you're right.
And so he was there playing, and he was able to see, Robert. I mean, I'm just going off of memory. I honestly have nothing pulled up, so I can't remember. But yeah, either way, whether he was actually there, or it was some, whether it's a theory or not. You think, when I think about Asha, I think that would be a likely way that she,
right,
could have been in that spot.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So now we kind of, in this chapter, we move on to the Kings of Winter, as I mentioned. So as they go down into the crypts, and really there's a quick description here. Let me see if I can find it. Lord Adam Parker brought this up when we did the whole Crypts of Winterfell. Going into season 8, we thought it would be a huge deal. We got the promo. We got all this stuff about what a big deal it would be. People were hiding down in the crypts. And it's this vast network. It's longer, I think it says, than Winterfell itself. So it kind of covers more ground. We'll get more on the crypts next book when we have to go down there and hide and take swords. So that's interesting. And while we're on that, real quick, just a side note for anybody who is ahead in Clash of Kings, Mickon's mark is something that you guys should look up, and his, the marking of his swords, and you know how that can be a mark that would legitimize Starks. Arya's has it, Rickon's sword has it, different things like that. So Mickon's mark. We'll talk more about that later. But yeah, as they're going down into this, down into the crypts, it says that Summer stalked out into the echoing gloom. He stopped, lifted his head, sniffed the chill dead air. He bared his teeth and crept backwards, eyes glowing golden in the light of the Maester's torch. Whew. And even Asha, hard as iron, seemed uncomfortable when before she said, "No problem, we'll go down there." So everyone has some sort of like hesitation going into the crypts, but these kids used to play down there. It was no problem. And maybe there's something with that in youth, because Rickon is still very young. He had no problem going down. He goes down with Shaggy Dog, which is what we're getting to. So maybe there's something there in just that innocence, or not knowing
right,
knowing what to fear, if you will. So yeah, they look at the granite stone statues, though, and Bran whispered, you know, they were the Kings of Winter. Asha says, "Winter's got no king." No king. Oh, really? Mr. Lewin says, yeah, they were the Kings of the North for 1,000 years. And this is where Bran goes through each of them. But before that, the vault was this huge cavernous place. It was longer than Winterfell itself. Jon had told him once that there were other levels underneath, vaults even deeper and darker, where the older kings were buried. So that's interesting. How deep does it go? We know that towards the back, there, to get to the lower levels, it seems to have been sealed off. And it seems that there's some, maybe a collapse or something that doesn't allow anyone to go deeper. And I wonder if Eddard Stark knows something about that, or if this was something that was supposed to be passed down from lord to lord, if there's some rumor as to what's beyond that, and who's the last person to have been down there.
Yeah, like perhaps an other, or I mean, Nisa, yeah. Nisa,
a white bride,
stuff.
Yeah. Exactly.
The whole deal.
Yeah, we just don't know. That was everything we were speculating about before season 8, hoping we get some huge connection to magic and some, you know, wards that were keeping a dead army at bay down there. We had all sorts of crazy theories going on. But yeah, so anyways, you know, we go over these Kings of Winter, as I said before, Jon Stark, again, who, you know, who built White Harbor, or who built the castle at White Harbor, who kind of built the Wolf's Den. His son, then, Rickard Stark, who took the neck away from the Marsh King. Theon Stark, the Hungry Wolf, who was always at war, warring with the Andals. Brandon the Shipwright, he loved the sea. His tomb is empty. He tried to sail west across the Sunset Sea and was never seen again. His son, Brandon the Burner, because he put the torch to all of his father's ships in grief. And then there's Roderick Stark, who won Bear Isle in a wrestling match. And Torrhen Stark, the king who knelt. right? The first Lord of Winter. So instead of king in the north, he was the first Lord of Winter. Yielded to Aegon the Conqueror. And Craegan Stark, who fought Prince Aemon once, the Dragon Knight. So there we go. Now, the part, the kings there, the statues I didn't mention, here we go. He says, and then there's my grandfather, Lord Rickard, who was beheaded by the Mad King Ares. His daughter, Lyanna, and his son, Brandon, are in the tombs beside him. Not me, another Brandon, my father's brother. They're not supposed to have statues. That's only for the lords and the kings. But my father loved them so much that he had them done. Okay. So there we go. And there's some, you know, Asha makes a comment just that she's, that Lyanna's very fair and it looks very pretty, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this is where we get a little tidbit about the betrothal between her and Robert Baratheon. And it says, but Prince Rhaegar carried her off and raped her, Bran explained. Robert fought a war to win her back. He killed Rhaegar on the Trident with his hammer, and Lyanna died, and he never got her back at all. And it, you know, turns out to be a sad tale. But is that the case? That's the question. Is that really what happened? There's so much more to that that story, and that's what we're covering in our Patreon series, going over the tourney at Harrenhal, the kidnapping of Lyanna, which is coming up next month, and we'll talk about leading into Robert's rebellion, how that really started.
Absolutely.
So,
but she says, but those empty holes are sadder.
You know,
Lord Eddard's tomb for when his time comes. Is this where you saw your father in your dream, Bran? Yes. The memory made him shiver. He looked around the vault uneasily, the hairs on his back of his neck bristling. Had he heard a noise? Was there someone here?
Mm. Yeah, and this is where Shaggy Dog shows up. Takes a little chunk out of Maester Luwin, right? He bites him in the arm, and Shaggy Dog has been having some issues, right? He's actually attacked a couple folks, and he's supposed to be locked up, but that just doesn't seem right. And we know from Catelyn later on that these Stark children should not be separated from their direwolves. We learn that later. Mm-hmm. We don't really know that now, but it's important that he stay close to his direwolf. And just sort of like Rickon, like Shaggy Dog is a little, they say that he's sort of feral and that he's he attacks and he's just sort of, he's kind of nuts, right? He's not tame at all. And it's just because he belongs to the youngest of the Stark children. So there's a wildness in him, which is interesting. But so yeah, he bites, he latches down on Maester Luwin, and Bran finally is yelling for Summer, who kind of disappeared into the back there. And here comes Summer jumping up, knocks Shaggy Dog down, knocked him back. The two direwolves rolled over and over in a tangle of gray and black fur, snapping and biting each other, while Maester Luwin struggled to his knees, his arm torn and bloody. So eventually, Rickon kind of calls Shaggy off, and then Bran calls Summer off, and so we're good, but it was definitely a scary moment, right? Imagine like a scary movie going down there and these direwolves jumping out of nowhere. Holy smokes. Scare the daylights out of you, wouldn't it?
Oh, yeah. Well, especially because there's a freaking direwolf coming at you.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what he says, though, is, you know, you let my father be. You let him. Rickon, Brands of Southfleet, father's not here. Yes, he is. I saw him. I saw him last night in your dream. You know, then Rickon nods. You leave him. You leave him be. He's coming home now like he promised. He's coming home.
Mm.
Then it says, Bran had never seen Maester Luwin look so uncertain before.
Wow. Yeah, that's the last person they expected down there, and that's also the last thing that they probably expected to hear. I mean, he was just scolding Bran about not being able to see his father. His father will be back later. He's a prisoner. He's not coming back. You really wonder what Maester Luwin thought after this. I wish there was a point of view of him back in his study, sort of rethinking everything he had been taught at the Citadel and wondering, maybe back to his youth, like, is there something to all these stories? Is there something to, these dreams and what's happening here in the North with the old gods and the Starks? I just, it'd be kind of cool to see that, to get that point of view. But, instead he kind of scolds him. Here just saying, as we said, that dog is a beast, or that direwolf is a beast. He's supposed to be chained up in the kennels. Rickon's not going to have any of that. He let him loose. He doesn't like chains. Very simply, who would? Right? So yeah, I mean, Bran's trying to comfort his brother a little bit, and they talk about how dark it is and how cold it is. I'm not afraid. I have to wait for father. You can wait with me, Bran said. We'll wait together, you and me and our wolves. Both the direwolves were licking wounds now, and would bear close watching, right? Yeah. So it takes some convincing to get Rickon to come out of hiding here and to go with them.
Yeah, yeah. No, I don't like it here. It's dark here and cold. I'm not afraid. I have to wait for father. You can wait with me, Bran said. You know, we'll wait together, you and me and our wolves. Which is the way it should be.
Yeah.
Keep your wolves close.
Exactly. Right. Right. Let's see here. Huh. Yeah, Maester Luwin talks about being the third man that he savaged, and he kinda says, like, if we don't lock him up and he keeps doing this, like, the word left unspoken is that we may have to, you know, kill him. Bran kind of fills in the blank there.
Right.
With his thought. So, anyways. It's Asha, though, who grins and says, the boy's the lordling here. Because he kind of says, like, you know, that they want to go, they want to go wait in the tower. That's where they want to go, up in Maester Luwin's study. And he's like, I don't think so. No way. Right? But she reminds him that, well, hold on a second. Bran is actually still in charge. So, actually, we're going to do whatever he says. And so,
right.
He throws that power back to him. And so they say, the Maester's Tower it is. Will you come, Rickon? His brother nodded. If Shaggy comes, too. Smart boy, right? Such a smart boy. So they do. They head back up to the Maester's study, if you will.
Yeah. And this is where we get a little bit of world building, as it talks about kind of like Maester Luwin's study. And this is really like the first kind of... You know, you don't just more of an insight, right? Kind of the Maesters. You know, it says his turret was cluttered, was so cluttered that it seemed to Bran a wonder that he ever found anything. Tottering piles of books covered tables and chairs, rows of stopped jars lined the shelves, candle stubs and puddles of dried wax dotted the furniture. The bronze mirrorish lens tube set on a tripod by the terrace door, star charts hung from the walls, shadow maps lay scattered among the rushes, papers, quills, and pots of inks were everywhere, and they were all spotted with droppings from the ravens in the rafters. The strident quarks drifted down from above as Osha washed and cleaned and bandaged the maester's wound under Luwin's terse instruction. So, yeah. You know, imagine his study is just, you know, just stuff everywhere, open
right.
books and, you know, string and all this kind of stuff. Sounds an awful lot like Sir Ezra's office.
I was going to say, it actually, I will take a picture and I'll have to post it. Like, I love this. I mean, as much as I want to be a hedge knight and just be out doing my thing, I also want to be half maester as well. I would love to have a little place to go back to and just have my study with all my papers and my lens tube, my mirrorish lens tube. That's a pretty cool reference there. And being able to see the stars, map them out, and just be, you know, gathering more and more knowledge and learning. Because, like, when Bran will ask him for some of the histories here, Maester Luwin just can automatically, boom, start reciting some of this stuff about the Children of the Forest and things, which is really neat in these histories. He just has it all in his head. And I love that. I think that's really cool that you can just turn to him and he's got it. Plus, he's running he's running Winterfell and helping Bran navigate what he's going through. He's very much... I don't know, underappreciated, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, of all the maesters, he and Marwyn, like, they're top-notch. Just really good. Really like them. So.
I mean, I think Pycelle does a pretty great job as well.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, sure. Good gravy.
That was a joke. Yeah, he says, you know, I agree that it's odd that both of you boys dream the same dream. When you stop to consider it, it's only natural. You miss your lord father, and you know that he's a captive. Fear can fever a man's mind to give him queer thoughts. Rickon is too young to comprehend. Then Rickon says, I'm four.
Right. You know? Matter of fact, I'm four.
Yeah,
so.
I'm four, okay?
Yeah. Back off. Yeah. You know, to Luwin's credit, though, right, he is trying to give them reasons, and he's trying to help explain it away because he doesn't know himself. And sometimes we think, like, the unknown is, it scares us a little bit. maybe as adults it scares us, but these kids, it's sort of like, I don't know, it seems pretty simple to them. He showed up in our dreams. He said he's coming home. He'll be here soon. I mean, like, it's just a matter of, it's a fact. So, all right. But,
okay. Yeah. So then we start getting a little bit of, kind of like old history here. They start talking about the children of the forest. Because OSHA says, you know, some, talking about dreams, says some are, some aren't. The children of the forest could tell you a thing or two about the dreaming. The children lived only in dreams, now dead and gone. Enough, that's enough. Now, you know, then Maester Llewelyn's saying, like, you know, let's get the bandages on here. Old Nan says the children knew the songs of the trees, that they could fly like birds and swim like fish and talk to the animals. She said that they made music so beautiful that it made you cry like a little baby just to hear it. And they did all of this with magic, Maester Llewelyn said. I wish they were here now. A spell would heal my arm less painfully, and they could talk to Shaggy Dog and tell him not to bite.
Right.
So he says, you know, take a lesson, Bran. The man who trusts in spells is dueling with a glass sword, as the children did. Here, let me show you something. He stands roughly across the room, returns with a green jar in his good hand. Have a look at these, he says. He pulls the stopper out and shook out a handful of shiny black arrowheads. Bran picked one up. It's made of glass. Mm. You know, dragon glass, as OSHA names it. Yeah, obsidian.
Yep.
Maester Llewelyn insisted.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Forged in the fires of the gods far below the earth. This is mm-hmm. what the children used, right? They didn't work with metal, but they had this dragon glass to hunt with and use and stuff. So, yeah, really cool. Yeah, that the man who would fight with that, or that who uses magic would essentially be using this dragon glass. And he kind of says that, like what he's trying to say here is that the children get beat. They get killed. They get destroyed. They get pushed back. And they get pushed back by... let's get into some of the histories. Maybe it's important to read some of this, too, because he talks about the Dawn Age first and sort of how the children were there, how there were no castles or holds or cities. There were no men at all. Only the children of the forest dwelt in these lands that we now call the Seven Kingdoms, and that was the Dawn Age. They were a people dark and beautiful, small of stature, no taller than children, even when grown to manhood. They lived in the depths of the woods and caves, crannogs, and secret tree towns. Slight as they were, the children were quick and graceful. Male and female hunted together with weirwood bows and flying snares. Their gods were the gods of the forest, stream, and stone, the gods whose names are secret. Their wise men were called green seers, and carved strange faces in the weirwoods to keep watch on the woods. How long the children reigned here, or where they came from, no man can know. So that's your Dawn Age reference, and this is the time before the first men come across the Arm. And if you think about Westeros as a map, so coming from Essos across into Westeros, there's what's known as like the Arm of Dorne, where it was once this maybe land bridge that you could come across this desert sort of area and come in south and then work your way all the way north in Westeros. And that's really how the first men kind of entered. And they came in on horses too, Sir Matt, which is interesting because the children were a little bit shocked that they had horses. You know, no horse had ever been seen on this side of the Narrow mm-hmm. Sea, which makes me think of the Dothraki and how
yeah.
the horses shouldn't be crossing the sea unless there's a land bridge.
Yeah.
They cross on land. That's how they did it. That's how they're supposed to do it.
So, yeah, I just like I like this line here, too. We're just we're just talking about, you know, it says in place of swords they carried these blades of obsidian, which, you know, is the real reason they lost, that they didn't have any way to actually combat men.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but then OSHA says and still do.
Yep. Exactly. Yeah. So moving in with their history a little bit here, yeah, the first men, the reason they'd have to go to battle is because the first men do appear on these horses, mm-hmm. and they start to kind of take over, carve out holdfast and farms, cut down the faces of the the trees, and they gave them to the fire, right? So the mm-hmm. children go to war with them.
Right.
It's said that the Green Seers use dark magic.
Yeah, that's what they'd have to use, because you know obsidian blades aren't gonna do the trick, and they would certainly have they would have really no answer towards, you know, like mounted cavalry with, you know, steel swords and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now here's an interesting line. So they used dark magic to make the seas rise and sweep away the land, shattering the arm, which we know is that the arm of Dorne, right? This land bridge that connected the two. But it was too late to close the door. And I just have wrote next to that, hold the door. Right. But anyways. So yeah, this war kind of goes on until finally they come to both races. The wise of both races prevailed, and the chiefs and the heroes of the First Men met the Green Seers and Wood Dancers amidst the weirwood groves of a small island in a great lake called God's Eye. And we've talked about the God's Eye. It's still it's easy to find on the Westerosi map, and Harrenhal is built right just near it, correct? I mean,
mm-hmm.
yeah, north or west of it. So yeah, this is where the pack kind of forms. The First Men kind of agree that they're going to have the coastlands, the high plains, the bright meadows, the mountains and bogs, but the deep woods were to remain forever the children's, and no more werewoods were to be put to the axe anywhere in the realm. So the gods might bear witness to the signing. Every tree on the island was given a face, and afterwards the sacred order of green men was formed to keep watch over the Isle of Faces. So that's the reminder that this pact was made between the First Men and the children. So and they live up to that. So the pact began 4,000 years of friendship between men and children. That's a long time.
Yeah.
So they lived at peace. This was a good time. In time, the First Men even put aside the gods they had brought with them and took up the worship of the secret gods of the wood. And the signing of the pact ended the Dawn Age and began the Age of Heroes. So the start of the Age of Heroes, there's this peace between children and First Men. So I kind of wonder, in the show that we're going to get, are we going to see some of that? So maybe some of the, is it going to start with some peace? Or something? Are we gonna see, like how?
Probably.
I
think it's gonna take place. I don't know. Do you think it's gonna start with Children of Forest and the others? I don't know.
I really don't know. I mean, the show is supposed to be called The Long Night, right? That's what George wanted it to be, right?
Right, but if it's the Age of Heroes, it's kind of afterwards. So I don't know. I mean, we'll find out when we get to it, I guess. But.
Yeah, I mean, we will. I mean, it's because now they've changed. What's the title of it going to be now? The working
title. They
said
Blood Moon there for a while, and then maybe like Project Blood Moon. It seems like they've gone back and forth a little bit on what it's actually going to be called.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So The Long Night, it occurred during the Age of Heroes, approximately 8,000 years before Aegon's conquest, in the midst of a great winter that lasted for years. So I'm thinking. That's why I was thinking, if it's the Age of Heroes, if that's when the Long Night kind of occurs, then perhaps we don't have to start with the pack, but maybe you start with it's just natural to see groups going into the forest and meeting with the Children of the Forest. It's a time of peace. Maybe they go in there and they seek wisdom, or they need a potion, or they need some guidance. Perhaps they go to the children, or they go to those old gods. If some of these First Men had sort of given up worship of their old gods and or the gods that they brought with them, and then turned to worshiping the gods of the forest, stream, right, and earth, then maybe we'd see some of that. That's a huge time period. You got 4,000 years of peace between them. And then I was even thinking, it's coming up here in just a moment, the idea that you're gonna have an Andal invasion. I think we could see a couple seasons if you wanted to, of like just these hundreds of kingdoms kind of warring, the First Men, if you will, and then you have an Andal invasion because they take over. So, but I don't know. I'm just speculating.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's see. Yeah. And then Bran, his fist curled around the shiny black arrowhead. But the children of the forest are all gone now, you said. And then Asha says, here they are, right? North of the wall, things are different. That's where the children went, and the giants, and the other old races. So she's saying, yeah, they're still around. And Maester Luwin kind of scolds her, like, hey, we're treating you pretty well, right? And don't be filling these boys' heads with all this craziness. But then Bran wants to know. You'll tell me. He's like, tell me where they went. I want to know. Me too, Rickon said. And then Luwin says, oh, very well. So as the kingdoms of the First Men held sway, the pack endured all through the Age of Heroes and the Long Night and the birth of the Seven Kingdoms. Yet, finally, there came a time, many centuries later, when other peoples crossed the narrow sea. The Andals were the first, a race of tall, fair-haired warriors who came with steel and fire and the seven-pointed star of the new gods painted on their chest. The wars lasted hundreds of years, but in the end, the six southern kingdoms all fell before them. Only here, where the king in the north threw back every army that tried to cross the neck, did the rule of the First Men endure. And it's also like the way the Andals win, too, we've read up on this, Sir Matt and I have, that it was more so to keep their rule, they intermarried. They made sure that they made marriage alliances and stuff and mixed the blood. So that way you wouldn't have these different factions of that kind of held out against them. Like the mountain clans over in the Vale, they didn't. They're kind of known for being strong descendants of the First Men and not mixing and not marrying in with the Andals. So that'll be interesting if that comes up in the show. All right. Yeah, so the Andals burnt out the Weirwood Groves, hacked down the faces, and the children fled north, right? And this is the, so as he says that, they fled north, and Summer howls, and then Shaggy Dog also bounds up and lets in a howl there too. They know something's coming,
mm-hmm.
right? So they know that this raven is coming with dark news, you know, dark words.
Hey, dark words, man.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Summer began to howl. It's coming, he whispered with a certain new despair. He had known since last night, since the crow had led him down into the crypts at Winterfell. The crow, he's thinking, the three-eyed crow. The howling stopped as suddenly as it had begun. Summer padded across the floor towards Shaggy Dog and began to lick at a mat of bloody fur on the back of his brother's neck. From the window came a flutter of wings. The raven lands on the gray stone still, opening its beak and giving a harsh, raucous rattle of distress. Rickon began to cry. His arrowheads fell from his hand one by one and clattered on the floor. Bran pulled him close and hugged him. Maester Luwin stared at the black bird as if it were a scorpion with feathers. He rose slow as a sleepwalker and moved to the window. He ends up taking the letter from its leg. You know, what is it? You know what it is, boy, Osha said, not unkindly. And, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
My lords, he said to the sons in a voice gone hoarse and shrunken, we shall need to find a stone carver who knew his likeness well.
Yeah. Yeah. So news that their father has been killed, and they're going to have to create that statue. So, they knew it. That's where I want to pick up with Maester Luwin that very night, and I want to know what he was thinking, right? What are his thoughts, his secret thoughts that he's not going to share with the rest of them? Like, what is he worried about? Does he believe in any of this stuff? I mean, it's crazy. Too much of a coincidence there. These boys have this dream the night before that their father was going to be there in the crypts, and then they get news of it that very same day. Just too much. Too much.
Yeah. I mean, he's probably in his mind, he's thinking these are young boys. They're just, you know, they're scared. He's just trying to calm them down, you know, keep the peace.
Yeah. But I gotta imagine any person I think would think that's odd. Any of us as readers would say, well, that's odd. That's strange. So,
well, you know, when it's just Bran having the dream, but then when it's Bran and Rickon, okay, now it's getting kind of creepy.
Yeah. Which is why I said that, you know, is that Maester Luwin right after this chapter, that's too much, too many things to be coincidence. I mean, so much. It's not just like that Rickon said he had a dream the same as Bran. He so much believed it that he went down into the crypts and was waiting. So that's just odd. That's just odd. And so you wonder what he would be thinking, because that's what we as readers are thinking. Like, oh, there's more. There's something going on here. There's something happening. And for him to be a learned man, and I know he's probably got years of the Citadel influencing him, just thinking they're trying to live in a world without magic and without these green dreams and these influences and stuff, which is hinted at when they talk about Maester Aemon. You know, the reason why he was left to kind of rot, if you will, up at the Night's Watch, and why he wasn't ever called on for counsel and stuff, is because they didn't want any, you know, they were happy living in a world where dragons weren't around and magic and powers seemed to be diminished, and people turned to them for wisdom and knowledge. So the Maesters are interesting. There's a lot of theories out there about the Maesters. So,
yeah.
But, all right. So there we go. There's the chapter. We kind of went over, we had some interesting cool connections to the histories and to Simeon Star Eyes, and we're learning more about the children there, the Dawn Age into the Age of Heroes, which is really neat. So if you ever want more information on those two ages, A World of Ice and Fire, that companion book that we started the podcast off with, has some good information there. So a few more details, I guess, if you will.
Yeah. All right. Well, hey, Sir Ezra, we have an amazing raven to get through here.
Yeah.
This is from Sir Chris of House Strovel. He says, "Hey guys, my early summer reread of The Song of Ice and Fire was spurred by an offhand thought I had while watching season 8. What percentage of characters who have appeared on this show did not survive this show? So I did my reread and kept a spreadsheet. Totally nerded out. It's attached for your perusal." And he says, "Each of the Seven Kingdoms gets its own sheet. The Iron Islands gets a separate sheet from the North. The Crownland gets a sheet, as does the Wall, the Free Cities, the Dothraki / Slaver's Bay. 12 sheets in all. I included characters who were left alive at the start of the books." He says, "Sorry, John Aaron, or born during the books. Any named characters? A few characters who don't get named but play a notable role in a scene. There's almost 1,600 characters. About 25% of them are dead, but I have almost 60% of them listed as unknown." So he says, "Now for the qualifiers. This is by the book, not the show. So Varys, has Miss Sandy," how we pronounce it, you know, like two separate words, "and a whole bunch of other folks are still alive here. There's going to be heirs, as you find out, as you find and point out, will be appreciated." He has a column for like a live / unknown status. "Three resurrected characters are all counted in the dead column, John, Kat, and Beric. Undoubtedly, some folks will be on the wrong sheet. You know," he says, "don't say I never gave you anything or burdened you with anything more correctly. First of all, thank you so much for this." I have it pulled up here. This this thing is pretty. I'm gonna see if I can, because I right now I have it in Excel format, so I'm gonna see if I can transfer it over to a Google Sheets and then possibly, you know, share it on like our Patreon page, since we can share docs and stuff there.
Yeah.
This thing is amazing. And yeah, basically what it is it's a huge Excel spreadsheet, and he has, so it's characters that we meet and kind of what their status is. Are they alive or dead? So here he has, you know, you go to the Crownlands here, and there are, in the Crownlands, there are 165 characters that like at least get a name.
Right.
In the books. I mean, that includes characters like, you know, he's got like guys, you know, people who just, you know, like somebody who's Kyle, who was a mummer, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Who's a Brotherhood Without Banners archer.
Yeah.
You know, what's his status? You know, up here he's got, you know, I mean, it's, you know, it's insane. So he has, you know, like, Robert Baratheon, then he has a column for, he has those who killed by a boar, then he's in the dead category. So there are, he has 66 people listed as dead. These are characters we meet throughout the series in just the Crownlands that have a name, you know, and we know that they're dead. Then he's got living 39, unknown 58. Some people who he has listed as unknown here, I think, are down here kind of towards the bottom. A lot of guys with, you know, Brotherhood Without Banners, the Mad Huntsman, Melly, Mudge, Merritt of Mootentown. And so he has that for each of the areas. I mean, it is insane. He has Catelyn Tully Stark killed by, and he just has Red Wedding listed as. So, I mean, it's an enormous spreadsheet. It is really, really well done. It is very well put together. I cannot imagine the amount of time that this would have taken. You would have at least had to read the books, and then every time you meet a character, put this in.
Yep.
It's really good. Like, it's really, really good.
Yeah, and put it in by region. And what's hard is sometimes you meet characters from a region, but they're in a different region when you meet them, you know? So you have to kind of distinguish there.
Okay, he has Khal Drogo killed by Dany.
yeah. I mean, so this is something I've said before. I'm really glad that we have this spreadsheet. This is awesome. So Book of the Dead, as it's called. Like, he has around 1,500 characters. 1,500 from Dorne, as you said, all the different regions to the Dothraki Sea. And it's like 900 of those characters unknown. You know, they're just mentioned once, and we don't know whether they died or they lived or whatever. They're just mentioned briefly. That's amazing. That's amazing that you have that many characters that you could go back and kind of either, you know, bring back up or finish off, tie off the story to. It's just, it's crazy. That's why it's so neat that he has just common folk passing by who get a name. They get a name in the story. They're described.
Yeah, I think he also has it. I think he has it broken down. Looks like he almost has it maybe broken down by book as well. Or he has some other kind of category here. Oh, it's house. Oh, he has it by houses. Okay. Because and it's listed. We're gonna have to share this because this is amazing, so everyone can take a look. But it looks like it's listed by where you're from. So you know, Robert Baratheon from the. Well, technically he's from, well, I guess you could count him as either the Stormlands or Dorne, but a lot of other characters, it's kind of like where they're from. So even though Catelyn Tully Stark dies at the Red Wedding, she's listed as a member of the North.
Yeah. Right. Man. That's it. This is incredible.
It's huge. It's a great resource. Trust me, we're going to be using it because it makes it easy to find out.
Yeah, you can just go through some in the Westerlands, and you look up like all of these men who are Lannister bannermen, and who they were killed by, and you know, a lot of them it's like they're unfinished. They're just referenced as being in the tent around a war council, but we never really know what comes of them. So. Sir Lambert Turnberry, Lannister soldier, right? I mean, and then this is why it gets to be overwhelming. You're just sort of like, what? I mean, you've got Lannister guards in the Hand's Tower. You've got, bannermen, brave companions. You've got Kevin's men, Sir Kevin's men. You've got, all of them with him. So Lord, yeah, that's insane. This is great. This is awesome. This is so, Sir Chris, this is awesome, man.
So I'm gonna convert this over to a like a Google Drive doc so we can share it on our Patreon. Mm-hmm. And so that people can look at it, and yeah, this is great. This is an amazing, amazing resource. Please send us a message with how long it took you to do this. We just had to listen every time a character's listen, all right, just insert, then what ends up happening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. All right. Well, yeah, thanks again there. So, cool beans. Let's move over here to Man the Wall. And as Sir Matt just said, we'll kind of maybe share. That's the type of stuff we share on Patreon or over in the Facebook group or what have you for folks to kind of look at resources and things, which is pretty neat. So that's one of the perks to helping us man the wall. We are currently doing the Tourney at Harrenhal series. I believe... Maybe by the time this episode is up, you'll have the musing that we did on the Blue Roses, on the Winter Rose, for that series. And then next month, we're covering part three of the Harrenhal series, looking at Lyanna's abduction and things like that, and sort of the aftermath of the tourney. and what took place there. So go check that out. Also, I've kind of continued working on Sir Matt got me fired up a couple weeks ago just to get back into that A Feast with Dragons, and so I've went back to my Green Dreams document and my sort of manifesto of ideas and theories and things that I'm working on. So I will probably be sharing a few of those because I was doing some research today just in some of these characters that have come up in this chapter and some of these Kings of Winter and some of the influences that they have. And they're also referenced later on in the stories too. And why are they referenced? And so I might be doing some more either Black Council or Green Dreams over there on Patreon. So definitely go check that out if you'd like to. And again, you can always help us out by leaving a review on iTunes. Those are definitely helpful. We really appreciate that. Joining the Facebook group, just participating. You know, we're talking about Lady Liz, and just, it's cool. I mean, just to see whether it's a meme, something that makes you laugh, or, you know, pulling a quote from, I love just being, when I find something in the book and we can just pull it and put it up there for discussion. I did that probably a few months ago before we went into the TV show, and I might go back to that, just finding stuff that made me, I really don't have any thought on it, but it's, I underline those things, that like the Simeon Star Eyes thing was kind of cool. It's something you could bracket and say, what does this mean? You know, does it mean we're really going to see Arya get that type of weapon later on, or is it another character who's going to get it? You know, Sir Matt and I have been talking about the differences between book and show and how it's all going to play out in the book. So so there's all of that. So yeah, head over to patreon.com/bendtheknee, or head over to the Facebook group and join up there, or just send us a raven.
All right, well, Sir Israel, I think it's time to say farewell. We want to thank you for playing the Game of Thrones. In our next episode, we'll be discussing Chapter 67, Sansa 6.
Yeah. If you like our podcast, don't forget to subscribe, like us, write a review, leave a comment, or send us a raven at btkcast@gmail.com.
We will see you in a week, and remember that winter is coming.